Today we're going to be learning together a little bit about Parshat Ki Tisa. Ki Tisa is a packed, deep, complicated Parsha. Ideally, I would have loved to have given it 3 or 4 shirim, kind of like we did back in Parshat Shemot. But the semester has gotten away from us. So we're going to touch upon some of the core issues and try to link together as many elements of the Parsha as we can in one long shir. But recognizing that even on the level of the extent that we go into each Parsha, there's a lot that will be left as food for thought, or if you listened into the last year's smell for thought, depending on your approach that you want to take. I do want to, though, begin by just outlining what is happening in Parshat Ki Tisa. First of all, what is the topic of Parshat Ki Tisa? If I were to ask you, what's the topic of Parshat Ki Tisa? Chet Egel, right? That's what it kind of is famous for, or infamous for, is it the Parsha of Chet Egel. And that's what we're going to be primarily focusing on and trying to understand, because there's a lot of difficulty in what is Chet Egel, how could Chet Egel happen. It's really an incredible thing. Like, what went wrong? What happened? We had all of this great forward momentum. We have Yitziat Mitzrayim. We experience the 10 plagues. We experience Kriyat Yamsuf. We experience the Man. We experience the Be'er. We experience the Anane HaKavod and the Eish at Night. And we have Matan Torah. And then 40 days after Matan Torah, we're able to come into Avodah Zarah. Like, how does that happen? What went wrong? And how do we understand in a more nuanced way what's actually happening here? How this could occur after Matan Torah? And how the lessons in this Parsha have to remain applicable to our lives through all generations, even in a reality where Avodah Zarah seemingly does not exist. And we're going to try to build that up. But what we also want to do, since it's the function of how we work in these Chumash Shirim, is also then make this Parsha just about Chet Egel. But there are a lot of other things that crop up in this Parsha as well, and I want to at least try to help us tie some of them in with these key themes. So let's very quickly outline Parshat Ki Tisa. What's happening in Ki Tisa? What do we first discuss? Which is the name of the Parsha. Ki Tisa Rosh Bnei Yisrael, Lifkudehem, V'natnu Ish Kofer Nafsho LaHashem. We're counting Bnei Israel? Sort of.
The census.
Right, so it's the census, which is counting people, but we don't count people. We actually very intentionally, this is about how to count people without counting people, which is really the topic of Parshat Shkalim, right? The collection of the Shkalim, by which to have the census, but without counting the people. And we'll come back to that later. Why is that the introduction to Parshat Ki Tisa? Why is this the opening paragraph? What's the relationship between Shkalim and counting the Jewish people and Chet Egel? This is the opening paragraph. So we have here, we're going to leave it up there as Shkalim, recognizing that it's counting the people, but again, specifically counting the people by a means that's not counting them. We're counting the coins. Then we have the same game we played last year. Right, so we have the Kior. Why do I say the same game that we played last year? What is the Kior? It's the wash basin, the laver, whatever that means. It's the wash basin, right? When the Kohanim would go to serve in the Beit HaMikdash and the Mishkan, so they would have to wash their hands and their feet from the wash basin. What does that mean? What is it then functionally? What is the Kior? What category does it fall under?
A kli of the Mishkan.
Where? What is the parsha of the kelim of the Mishkan? What's the parsha of the kelim of the Mishkan?
Truma.
Remember, that was the question we asked last time when we went through Parshat Tetzaveh. We had the begadim of the Kohanim themselves, and then what's the Mizbeach Azav doing there? And that we had to answer that question. We spent the whole last year answering that question because it belongs in Parsha Truma. So too, why is the Kior, which is one of the kelim of the Mishkan, not only missing Truma, it even missed Tetzaveh, to all be put all the way down to Parshat Ki Tisa? Interesting. We open up with Shkalim and then the Kiyor. We're not going to directly address this, but what comes next? Good. The Shemen HaMishkan, and after that as well. The Shemen HaMishcha, and then the next paragraph is what actually makes up the Ketoret itself, not the altar, but the spices. The anointment oil that's used to sanctify something is becoming part of the Mishkan of the Beit HaMikdash, and then the Ketoret, the spices that go into making the Ketoret. Then we have, again, like I said, there's going to be too many pieces here to cover in one shiur. We'll try to get as many in as we can. Then we have what? Bezalel. This one we can answer up a little bit more clearly. What is Bezalel's job? To build the Mishkan. So why is it waiting until here to introduce Bezalel? Why wouldn't we introduce him in Truma or Tetzaveh? Excellent. Meaning, just in terms of the narrative, that makes sense. Why is he in Kitisa? So that's a question that we're going to leave as an open question. But why would we only introduce Bezalel here? Because in Truma Tzava we introduced how to build the Mishkan. Now we need the who to build the Mishkan, and then we can go to Vayachal B'Kudei and actually build the Mishkan. So that's why Bezalel is being waited until later to be introduced, but we haven't answered, when we're not going to, why he's in Kitisa in particular. And before Chet HaEgel. Then, as long as we're throwing up random things on the board, seemingly, obviously that's tongue-in-cheek, everything here has a reason and a purpose and an order, but as long as we're throwing quote-unquote random things on the board, then we have
Shabbat.
Why not? All right, take a break in the Parsha. We have almost enough items up here to get to seven, so seventh item is Shabbos, take a rest, and then get back to the narrative. So the question is, what is Shabbat doing here? And that's obviously an incredibly important question that needs to be addressed. And why is Shabbat consistently being brought up in the context of the Mishkan? Is a shir unto itself. Then we move on to Chet HaEgel. And Chet HaEgel pretty much takes us through the rest of the Parsha. Moshe Rabbeinu goes up. They miscount how long he's up there. And he comes back down. He has to break the luchot because they've made an egel. Moshe Rabbeinu has to daven on their behalf. Eventually he receives the luchot shniot. And then comes back down with the luchot shniot. Very much short summary of that very long end of the Parsha. Okay? So we're going to try to, at least in one shiur, try to tie some of these things together and really just jump at the heart of the Parsha and see how many pieces we can draw into it at the end, which is the issue of Chet HaEgel itself, which you've already prefaced by saying that Chet HaEgel is, like, it's unbelievable. How does Chet HaEgel happen? How is it possible that Chet HaEgel happened? How is it possible that 40 days after Matan Torah, how is it possible after everything that they saw and experienced, how is it possible that we talked about, they only heard two luchot, they heard, two dibrot rather, they only heard two dibrot, Anokhi Hashem Elokecha and Lo Yelecha Elohim Achirim Al Panai, don't make other gods. More food for thought, Lo Yelecha Elohim Achirim Al Panai, and what do they make in Egel? Masecha, which is translated as a molten calf, but what is Masecha also? A mask. Lo yalacha Elohim achrim al panai, and then they end up making an egel Masecha. It's a lot of issues of, if you look throughout the parsha, there's a lot of issues of face revealing, hidden. Moshe Rabbeinu wants to see God's face. There's a lot of discussions of, he comes down, he has to put a mask on his own face. Whole nother layer again that we could do a whole shir on that. Like I said, there's many shirim here that we're not able to do, but I want to at least leave you with the issues that this parsha opens up, again, as food for thought. But that's one of the two people they heard. Don't have other gods. They're like, got it. And then a little over a month later, anybody up for making a molten calf and going and bowing down to it? Like, how does that happen? It's totally illogical. It seems simply impossible. So to begin to enter into what that's about, let's take a look at just how things degenerate at the beginning of Perek Lamed Bet. Perek Lamed Pasuk Aleph. Vayar Ha'am Ki Voshesh Moshe Laredet Min Ha'har. The nation sees that Moshe, in their minds, has delayed from coming down from the mountain. Vayikahel Ha'am Al Aharon. They come to Aharon. The people come to Aharon. Vayomru Elav, and they say to him, Kum Aselanu Elohim Asher Yochul Lefaneinu. Come and make us a God who will walk before us. Ki ze Moshe ha'ish asher ha'elanu mi'eretz Mitzrayim. Because this Moshe, the person who took us out of Egypt, already something clearly problematic there, Moshe who took us out of Egypt, lo yadano mehayalo, we don't know what happened to him. V'yomer aleihem Aharon, so Aharon says, pirku nizmeh ha'zahav asher ba'uznei neshechem b'neichem uvenoteichem ve'eviu elai. Take out the rings of gold from the ears of your wives and your children and bring them to me. So he was, as the Mepharshim pointed out, trying to delay them and hoping that Moshe would get down from the mountain, right? Hope he would get down sooner rather than later. But they, in their zest and zeal to get this done, vayitparku kol ha'am et nizmei hazahav asher ba'oznehem, they went and took it right off of their wives and children. Vayaviu al Aharon, vayikach mi'adam, he took it from them. Vayitzar oto b'cheret, vayaseu egel masecha, this egel masecha comes out when he throws it into the fire. Vayomru, and then all of Klal Yisrael say, I want to focus on that for a second. Hear the words here. What do they say? What are the exact words? Eila Elohecha Yisrael Asher He'elucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Does that sound familiar to anyone?
Isn't that what they just said about Moshe?
True. What does it sound like a little bit farther back? Eila Elohecha Yisrael Asher He'elucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Tzitzika Me'eretz Mitzrayim. The Lashon is almost exactly parallel. I mean, it's the difference is that there's between Avodas Hashem and Avodas Hara. But there's clearly a hearkening back here in the Lashon itself to.
Jonathan likes the word hearkening.
Oh, okay. to the Aseret Divrot themselves. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hetziticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim versus Eila Elohecha Yisrael Asher Helucha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. And things again go downhill from there. So in order to understand what's happening here, let's zoom out and actually discuss a separate issue, a little bit more of an out there issue, and hopefully bring it back together in a way that will begin to add layers of clarity to these issues. There are many, many different names for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of all of the names for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, one of them stands out as being totally odd in its structure. What names for HaKadosh Baruch Hu do we have? Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, Shem Havaya.
Kel Shakai.
Elohim. So we got? Even just working with those, let's leave it there. Even of those three, which one stands out as being odd in the context of Judaism in the way that the word is structured?
Elohim.
It's very odd to Sima. Because the word Elohim seems to be plural, which is antithetical to what we believe as Jews. How does that work? How do we have a name for God that's in plural? What does that mean? How do we deal with that? There are many different ways in which that's discussed. The Ramban has a beautiful pshat where he explains the name Elohim is... What happened to the word here? In Elohim. When it's written out, it's with the cholam. Right? Elohim. The name Elohim.
Okay.
What? He understands as Kel Haim. The force behind all other forces, which is generally how we relate to the term Elohim itself as well. He understands it as Kel Haim. It's the force behind all their forces. In a similar vein, but adding a little bit more substance, the Zohar explains the name Elohim as follows. The Zohar says that the name Elohim is a composite of two words. What two words are in the name? Elohim. What's the first one? What? Okay. Keep going.
Aleph.
And if you swap the other two letters?
Me.
Says the Zohar that those are the two words that comprise the word Elohim.
Shouldn't it just say, shouldn't it be pronounced
Elohim? Can ask for sure, Mariachai. That those two words exist within the word Elohim. It's the same building blocks. Anyway, we've talked about how the letters are the building blocks of the word, regardless of the form that they happen to take. And we see word plays like that all the time in terms of different organizations of letters somehow still having to draw from the same root. Go with it for the purposes of the way the Zohar presents it. Okay? The Zohar presents it as such, as Ela and me. What does the word Ela mean?
These.
What does the word me mean?
Who.
These and who. That's what the name Elohim is coming to indicate. How so? The world that we live in is full of theses. It's full of multiplicity. It's full of division. It's full of seemingly unique entities that are floating around, right? There's me, there's you, there's a desk, there's a chair, there's a desk chair, there's a, there's a window, there are trees, everything out there is doing its own thing. And even in terms of the way the world functions, through science, we've come to determine that there are elemental forces at work. There are reasons why things happen. We know that there's a force of gravity, there's a strong force, there's a weak force. There are reasons why things happen in the world. There are many, many, many theses in the world. For the outside world, that's where they stop. They stop at these. They stop at the Ela. They look at the world and they see the multiplicity of reality. And we even talked about that in the Matan Torah shiur. The multiplicity versus the unity, the Bet of Bereshit versus the Aleph of Anochi. But the world is looking and seeing a reality of multiplicity. The job of a Jew is to look past the multiplicity of reality and see that there is something that lies behind all of that. What is it that lies behind all of reality?
Elohim.
No. What lies behind all of reality? A question mark. And we talked about in the Derech Hashem Shirim. There's something beyond it that unifies it, as we talked about in the Yitro Shirim. There's something beyond it. There's something that unifies all of it that is entirely beyond my comprehension. There's something infinite that stands behind the finite view of reality that I have. That's something that I don't understand. It's a me. It remains a question mark. I don't understand it. It never ceases to be a me. But I recognize and I know and I believe and it's clear to me that there's something else that's what makes everything in reality work. Say I have a tree. Right, I'm growing a tree in my backyard. So I want it to grow. So I plant it. I water it. I give it sunlight. Maybe I even sing to it. Talk to it. Science that has shown that actually being nice to a plant and emotionally tending to the needs of the plant makes the tree grow better. True story. So I go and I do everything I'm supposed to do. Water it, sunlight, give it its nutrients, everything it needs. I speak to it, I take care of it. And the tree grows into this beautiful, glorious tree. Why did the tree grow? So the tree grew because I watered it, and I took care of it, and I gave it sunlight, and I sang to it. Right? It doesn't mean your voice. Maybe me, if I sang to it, that wouldn't help. But like, it that's why it grew. That's why it grew. A Jew says, no, that's not why it grows. The tree grows for one reason and one reason alone. And that's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to the tree, grow. Elohim is the word that we use, is the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we use to indicate God's presence through nature. The fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu works in a systematic way in this world, in a consistent way, when He interacts with this world. That when we water trees, and when we give sunlight trees, and we take care of them in those ways, HaKadosh Baruch Hu then generally always makes them grow. But we never cease to recognize that it's always the hand of God. It's always the Ratzon Hashem. It's always HaKadosh Baruch Hu who's making that happen. The ultimate force behind all forces is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The ultimate power behind all powers is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Come back to the Ramban's definition if it speaks to you more. Kael Haim. There's all of these Haims in the world. It's the same idea. There's all this multiplicity in the world, but there is one singular force that stands behind them and unifies them in that way. There's one ultimate cause, and that cause is the Kadosh Baruch Hu. We like just missed it, but timely for this time of the year. Unbelievable story in the Gemara and Ta'anit. I don't have it here on my sheet, but I've told it many times. It's a story where many of us might be familiar with. Unbelievable story. Gemara and Ta'anit tells the story of the daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Familiar with it? Amazing story. So the daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, one Erev Shabbos, she's in a rush to light Shabbos candles. And she goes, and she quickly grabs the flask, and she goes to light, and she puts it inside, and she lights the candles, and it's Shabbos. Father comes home from shul. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa comes home. She's bawling. She's bawling. And he says to her, Biti, what's wrong? What's going on? Why are you so upset? And she says, I'll tell you what happened. It was Erev Shabbos, and I was running, and I went to go and light the candles, and I accidentally took vinegar instead of oil. And I lit the candles with vinegar. So first question is why is she crying? Because what is she looking at right now? A miracle. That's amazing. The Gemara is not like she was crying tears of joy and amazement. She's like bawling that she said that the vinegar is lit. What's even stranger is the response of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa to his daughter. He says, I think I'm quoting this exactly, Biti, ma yichpat lach? My daughter, what difference does it make to you? Mi sheyomar lishemen v'yidlok? Yomar lachomets v'yidlok? He who says that oil should light, should say the vinegar should light. End scene. Very interesting, cryptic story. All these stories about Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa that are in the end of Masechet Tanit are fantastic and unbelievable. But what's one layer of what's being brought out there is this very concept. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa is turning to his daughter, and the lofty level that his daughter was on needs to be discussed in a separate shiur another time. But like, she was crying for a very good reason, and because she was in a tremendously lofty place. She understood exactly what was happening. And his words were, in fact, consoling to her. But for our purposes, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa's replying is, what difference does it make to you? You're telling me that just because, and again, this is not where she was at, but for our purposes, you're looking at this little wick that you're putting in to a bunch of liquid, and then you're taking fire that's on a piece of wood, and you're taking it from the wood, and you're putting it on the wick, and then it's somehow going against the force of gravity, drawing up this liquid into the wick, and because the liquid's there, then this funny thing called fire, which is totally crazy in and of itself, just keeps going. So fine, you can give me an entire chemistry lesson about why that works. And we like to. We feel a sense of ownership if we can explain it through science. And we're supposed to. But he understood at a deeper level, it doesn't matter. It's totally crazy. Why is the fire lighting? Why is the whole thing just burning up? Why is fire able to stay there? Why is the it doesn't matter. The fire is lit for one reason and one reason only when you light the oil. Because the Kaddish Baruch Hu says so. And so for you, again, parentheses, Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's daughter, who was on such a lofty level that it honestly doesn't make a difference to her either, and that's why she's experiencing the miracle, according to one pshat. For you, since you have the clarity of vision, because you're living in a reality where you understand the Ela and the Me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows that for you it's just as miraculous and just as unmiraculous for both vinegar and oil to light. For you, He knows you don't see a miracle in it, because He knows that for you, you see the Yad Hashem in everything that's happening. That was the lofty level of Rechininos' daughter. The world, when it looks out at all of these things and sees them as being fundamental forces. What is the, thinking back to the roots of Avodah Zarah, what are the visas that the other nations of the world would look to and assume that they were the forces behind everything?
Denial.
What?
Denial.
More generic, more broad than just Mitzrayim.
Nature, like the sun.
Keep going. The sun and the moon. So is that nature or that's what specifically?
Heavenly.
The heavenly bodies.
Yeah.
Right? The stars. The stars were in control of everything. Because the non-Jews look up to the sky, and as far as they can see are the stars, and they assume that's how far we can go, and it stops at the end of my ability to take it in. And therefore, I'm going to bow down and worship the stars. Hence the term that we use for Avodah Zarah is also Akum, Ovdei Kochavim Mazalot. People who worship the stars and the heavenly constellations. Because that's where they stop. Listen to this amazing pasuk from Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu turns to the Jewish people and he cries out to them. Perek mem pasuk chaf vav. Put it on the board. He says, Si'u marom einechem ure'u mi bara ila. Turn your eyes toward the heavens. Su marom einechem. Turn your eyes to the heavens. Uru and see what? Mi bara ila. See who truly created these? It doesn't stop at the stars. Why does he phrase it like this, though? Look at the pasuk. Why does he phrase it like this? What's the response to the Avodah Zarah of the world of bowing down to nature, bowing down to the constellations? Turn your eyes toward the heavens and be very cognizant. Me. Focus on the me. Don't get lost and don't stop at the stars. Me bara ele. Who created all of these? What's the me that stands behind all of them? Did I spell something wrong there?
Today?
Okay.
I think it's a song.
Oh, is it really?
I think so.
I think it's from one of the Haftarot of the Zayin and Nechemta, so people might be more familiar with the Pasuk. It's definitely possible. But it's an unbelievable way he phrases the Pasuk in that sense of emphasizing. Always look at the beyond. Always look to see what's beyond that. Finishing up with this piece also. Oh, I do have the Gemara right here from Tanit. It's Tanit of Chaf Hamad Aleph, the story of Rechina Moses' daughter. What's the Gematria of me? We've talked about this before.
50.
What does 50 come to represent? Everything that we're talking about. The entire infinite and unknown. Very simple structure, that the way that it's built up. What does 7 always indicate?
Nature.
Nature, teva. 8 is? Lemala mina teva. Right? As we do specifically on Sfirat Omer time, we don't just want to define what's in reality, the physical world, that's 7 versus 8. What do we do in Sfirat Omer to indicate all things that ever could or would be in the physical world?
7
times 7, meaning if there are 7 fundamental elements. We're saying there's no such thing. It keeps going and going and going. It's a world of multiplicity. So even those 7 fundamental elements themselves must be comprised of the very same 7 fundamental elements. So 7 times 7 indicates the vast multiplicity of the physical world that ever could be. One beyond that, one beyond any possibility within reality as we experience it, that's 50. That's Matan Torah. That's a day where even though the Torah commands us in Sfirat HaOmer to do what? What's the mitzvah of Sfirat HaOmer? Aside from the Korban HaOmer?
Count.
To count. The Torah says, count 50 days. And what do?
We count
49. We absolutely don't count 50. We go against the clear pasuk, which says count 50 days. And Rav Akiva Tetzer points out that because the only way to count 50 for real is to not count the 50. Because you can't give it definition. Because 50 in its essence is that which is beyond. It's that which is relating to the impossible nature of what we talked about, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu taking his infinite essence and and putting an infinite essence somehow into the Torah and giving it over to us. That's something that's totally beyond us. 49 years in the Yovel cycle, the 50th year, all things are forgiven and slaves go free and everything returns to... What's this whole craziness? Something that's beyond the natural order of the way that the world works. It's just everything suddenly goes out of whack. In a way that needs to be understood by the context of Shemitah and Yovel. But 50 is always one beyond. And that's why me is that question mark. Me also, and it's the form it takes in Elohim, is in the form of Yam. And as we talked about before, what does a Yam symbolize? What does it essentialize in the world? What is it embodying in the world? Or go to the ocean? Look out at the sea? Looking out at the sea, and the sources bring this down, you get that sense of this infinite endlessness as it can, to the extent it can be expressed in the physical world. It goes as far as the eye can see. It seems to be infinite in terms of its breadth. And it goes so deep down, infinite in terms of its depth. Which isn't to imply that, again, that it ends with the physical world, but a yam is related to the me. It's this infinite wonder of what's out there. There's an infinite source that's behind it that creates all of these. Good? And with that, no, I'm kidding. Meaning, how does it all relate to Chet HaEgel? Because that's where we started with. So let's bring it back. Let's explain why we went on that journey and bring it back to Chet HaEgel. B'nai Yisrael. One second. Okay, good. B'nai Yisrael come out of Mitzrayim. While they're in Mitzrayim, what do they see? What do they experience in Mitzrayim? What are they watching happen in Mitzrayim?
Cool.
The Makot. What are the Makot doing?
Turning nature upside down.
Yes. And doing so for the purpose of what?
Revealing God.
What?
Revealing God.
That's incredibly lofty. Practically speaking, who is not thinking that? Who's running, screaming for their life?
Mitzrayim.
These are 10 stages of systematically decimating the strongest world power of that time. They are watching God, beat by beat, destroy this nation. It's a very frightening portrayal of God. It's also, perhaps, a very balanced and fair perception of God. Because the Egyptians did terrible things. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is expressing his midah of judgment upon them. He's coming down on these people who torture the Jewish people. And what they're experiencing, what they're feeling, what they're relating to, is a God of din, a God of judgment. That's their introduction to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for an extended period of time. And even in the moment that we talked about, which is a glorious moment at Kriyat Yam Suf, where he then turns the tables and opens up the waters for us, what's the conclusion of that story on the other side? He drowns the Mitzrim. The Jews deserve to be saved. The Mitzrim don't deserve to be saved. The Jewish people walk out of Mitzrayim with a very particular view of what they think God is. And what we've been talking about in terms of the Sefer Shmot, with an expression of one facet of God, one side of the way that God reveals himself in this world, one part of the way that we feel God's presence in this world. They're experiencing God's din in this world. And on a subtle level, on a very subtle level, because we're talking about one of the loftiest generations that ever lived with the generation that was in the desert. The Gemara refers to them as the Dor De'ah. They were a generation which had a da'at, a close connection, as we talked about. Da'at means connected. A connection with the Kadosh Baruch Hu in a way that defines who they were. They were a generation of da'at. And it's not to be taken lightly. These weren't people who were like, shoot, Moshe didn't come down, let's build an egel. And we're like, even we wouldn't do that. And of course we wouldn't do that because we wouldn't be smart enough to do that, says the Ramban. We wouldn't be smart enough to do that. That what happens is that B'nai Yisrael come out and they imagine that not that there's an aspect of God that's din, but that God is a God of din. And so Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Har Sinai and he says, before he goes up, probably not, I don't know if it remembers explicitly in the Pasuk, but what does he basically tell B'nai Yisrael?
I'll be back.
In? 40 days. Din. Specifically, 40 days. They miscalculate. What happens when they miscalculate? What do they assume?
He's not coming back.
Something went wrong. Maybe Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake. Something went wrong. I don't know what happened up there. God is the God of Din. If anything went wrong, maybe Moshe Rabbeinu is never coming back down. And if it was 40 days, it's exactly 40 days. And so the moment that Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't make it back, when they think he needs to be back at that second, they assume there was a din, something went wrong, and Moshe Rabbeinu is not coming back. So then they go ahead and they build an egel. Why do they build an egel? What is an egel? Calf, a baby ox. So why an egel and not a shore? We're not going to get into that. What were they doing when they were building an egel? What were they doing when they were building a baby ox, a shore? I believe it's in the Ramban. I don't remember if it's in the Ramban or if it's when I heard Rav Katz describing what the Ramban was talking about. That they were relating to the deepest levels of all things that were. We talked about the tremendous things that they saw at Kriyas Yamsuf. They were drawn from Nevuahs, like the Nevuah of the Maaseh Merkava. On the Maaseh Merkava, there are four different items on each corner of the Merkava, each one indicating one expression of the way that God rules the world. One of them is a shore, one of them is an ox. What does an ox indicate? What does an ox do functionally in agricultural times?
Plows.
What's plowing all about? Plowing means I go, I plow the field, I plant, and what do I reap? It's an expression.
What I sow.
I reap exactly what I sow. No more and no less. Action, reaction. Din. Their image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is an image of Din. And so they draw from the Maaseh HaMerkava itself and build, again, why an egel, not a shore b'seder. But they build an egel. They build an image that reflects their perception of what God is. They build a shore. They build an egel that reflects a God as singularly being a God of Din. Yeah.
Sorry, what's the Maaseh Merkava?
It's considered one of the deepest, if not the deepest, nevuah that there is, and describes how the world functions from HaKadosh Baruch Hu guiding the world. If one can understand what's going on in that nevuah. It's intentionally a very obscure nevuah. Now, we don't necessarily relate to the concept of Avodah Zarah. So they were worshipping their image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We don't have Avodah Zarah anymore in our time. How do we relate to this? Why is this such a... It's a sin that's so deep, that's so significant. So significant, by the way, that the Gemara tells us that every single tragedy that comes upon Klal Yisrael for the rest of time from this moment, there's a little bit of compensation, of response from HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what we did at Chet HaEgel. What's so significant? How does that relate to us? Why don't we have Avodah Zarah anymore?
They daven that it should go away.
So Ksima's quoting a Gemara in Masachet Yoma. Masachet Yoma and Daf Samach Tera Medbet. Wild Gemara. The Gemara says as follows. After the Chorban Abayit, Jewish people looked to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and they were like, enough already! We clearly can't do it. We've tried and we've tried and we've tried. And you fought with us, they don't say it in these words, we fought with us all through Chumash and certainly all through Nevi'im. to get us to stop worshiping idols. And you know what? We don't have what it takes. And so they say very powerfully, we're not interested in the mitzvah, and we're not interested in the schar. Get rid of both. But no more avodah zarah. Don't want to deal with that anymore. And so they have a tanit, and they dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu. An unbelievable response that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in response, nafalu pitcha mirakia, there's a note that falls down from heaven. Dehavi kativ ba'emet. After they daven and they fast, so a petah comes down from Shemayim that says emet. Because we actually talked about last year by Yaakov, the Shirim by Yaakov, you know, emet is the signature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. See those Shirim for how that relates to a more supernal essence. But emet is the chotem, is the signature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Amr v'chini ashma minah, again, chotemo shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu emet. Otzilu tanit atzlata yome utzlata leluta, they went and fasted for 3 days and 3 nights. Masru nihilihu nafak atagura denura mi beit kodshe hakatashim. So they daven and they fast, and 3 days later, suddenly, the embodiment of the yetzer for avodah zarah emerges. What does the yetzer hara of avodah zarah look like? Like a what? A lion. Gurya. A lion comes out. Gurya denura. Mazanura. Think back to the Pesach Seder. Atanura. Fire. A fiery lion jumps out. Okay. Fiery lion jumps out from the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Amar, Lehu, Navi, Li, Yisrael. The Navi says, Yisrael. Hainu Yitzra Devodah Zarah. This is the Yitzra Devodah Zarah. Shneamar vayomer zil tarisha. Okay. Bahadi tafusale ishtamit binita mimazia v'ramakalia v'azakalia arba mea parse. They go and they grab this lion, and when they grab it, one of its hairs falls off, and they throw it into a box, and they put it away. No more avodah zarah. Now, obviously, this Gemara needs tremendous amount of explanation. We're going to, again, draw a little bit for what we're using, a little bit of the emes of what's coming out of it that relates to what we're talking about here. There are a few things to really think about, to key into here, when recognizing what's happening here in the story. We're davening to remove the Yetzer Hara from Avodah Zarah. Other than the question of why it looks like a fiery lion, what else is striking in this Gemara? Where does it come from? The Kodesh HaKadoshim. How odd. Of all places for the Yetzer Hara from Avodah Zarah to come and jump out of, the Kodesh HaKadoshim was not the top of my list of obvious choices. The most Kodesh place, the most sanctified place, the place we're closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it jumps out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What is the Yetzer Hara from Avodah Zarah doing from the Kodesh HaKadoshim? The Gemara is indicating something very, very important and critical to whether or not we are Ovdei Avodah Zarah or not, even Bizman HaZeh. That sometimes the line between Avodat Hashem and Avodah Zarah is a very, very thin line. It doesn't always have to be huge idols outside, bowing down to them, like all of the images we get in the Nevi'im. True. But in the most internal chambers, there are deeper layers of Avodah Zarah. There's an Avodah Zarah of the Avodah Zarah that we are still susceptible to, which is bowing down to my image of God, to the image that I have of what I imagine God to be, in a way where I think I'm serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but I'm really doing Avodah Zarah. When somebody says, and I'm not coming down on them in the sense people go through pain in their lives, but when a person says, how could I believe in God? My God would never do such a thing. How could I believe in such a thing? The answer to that question is, you're right. Your God wouldn't do such a thing. But a Kadosh Baruch Hu would do such a thing. And one has to understand what that means. That we walk around with so many childish notions of what we imagine a Kadosh Baruch Hu to be. When we talk about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and we're not going to go on the tangent that you may all be expecting, which we're not going to go on, but I'm saying you know where from, in my heart of hearts, where this is also coming from. We only talk about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, really, younger ages, when we're kids, songs when we're small children, nursery school. For most of the world, the image of God that they have is the image of God that they got from their nursery school teacher, who may or may not have been qualified to give them the answer as to what God is or is not. And then we grow up, and we have serious, important things to learn. What's the one thing we don't talk about? We never talk about a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Very famously, I think it's Guru Gil, who was by the Kotel. There was this individual, he's around in the Old City. And he went around looking from religion to religion to find out what he was looking for. And he went from religion to religion to religion to religion, and he walked into a Beit Midrash at one point to see what the Jewish religion is about. And he actually said, and he relates this story, he walked into a Beit Midrash, he said he was taken aback. He saw a room full of people talking about everything under the sun. There was nothing they wouldn't talk about in a Beit Midrash. He said that the whole time the only thing that they didn't talk about was God. Oxes and walls and damages and this, all of these things they're talking about. Everything that there is to talk about in the world. The one thing we don't talk about a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And we don't fix the fact that the image of God that we have is an image of God very often that we get in childhood. And we leave it there. And we don't touch it. And we don't deal with it. And we don't let it develop with us as we grow older. And we don't recognize that the image of God that we have may not be as sophisticated as we are now. And that it needs to grow with us. And that if we bow down to the image of God that we have, it is no less Avodah Zarah. You want to tell me that's a fine line? I'll tell you you're right. We want to give a measurement, something that's so thin and so fine. What are some terms that we use for that? Kechut Asara. In English, we would say? A hair's breadth. My Rebbe doesn't say this, but I think it's Pashut from the Gemara. The Gemara was out of its way to say, they grabbed that fiery line and put it in that box, but one strand of hair fell off before they were able to put it in. I suspect, and if you see any other different pshat that said that it's contradictory to what I'm saying, I'm happy to be wrong. I strongly suspect that that's being emphasized by the Gemara itself. That hair's breadth between Avodah Zarah and not Avodah Zarah, that still exists. That's still out there in the world. That we still experience to this day. The overt bowing down to idols, that doesn't really interest people so much anymore. But not leaving behind my image of a Kadosh Baruch Hu and truly servicing that, which at the end of the day comes back to so many conversations we've had about service of the other versus service of self. Really, I'm just worshiping myself. I'm worshiping my image of God, which is really another way of saying worshiping myself. I'm worshiping my view of the world, the way that I see things. That's Avodah Zarah. Nothing more and nothing less. And on the finest of levels, in ways that we can't even imagine, and from the loftiest of places, that's exactly what was going on. By the Dordea, by Chet HaEgel. They truly saw Kadosh Baruch Hu as a God of Din. They saw Kadosh Baruch Hu as Ela Elohecha Yisrael Asher Elucha Mi'eretz Mitzrayim. As a God of Elohim, a God of Din. They got stuck in that perspective and they couldn't get out of it. What phrase appears by Chet HaEgel and the limited perspective that B'nai Yisrael by Chet HaEgel that actually doesn't really appear anywhere else in Torah except by repetitions of Chet HaEgel? A term which we actually throw around a lot more than exists in Chumash. Am Ksheoref comes from this parsha. Am Ksheorefu. We're stiff-necked people. What does it mean that we're stiff-necked people? We're stubborn. We are stubborn. Jews generally tend to be stubborn. Maze Am Ksheoref. I'm locked. My neck is locked, looking in this direction with this perspective only. And God complains to Moshe. What's the problem with these people? They're unwilling to see the full scope of my infiniteness, of my me. They're an Am Ksheorof. They're a stiff-necked people who are unwilling to move out of their narrow vision of what God is and what the world is. That's essential and connected to the sin of Chet HaEgel very specifically. And it appears primarily here and primarily in Devarim, in Akev, by the repetition of Chet HaEgel. Basically nowhere else in Chumash. You can double check me on that. Basically nowhere else in Chumash. And it comes up again and again and again in these parshiot. Because this parsha is about that limitation of perspective. And the Avodah Zarah that leads to. How do we serve God properly then? What do we need to do to lose in order to have a proper service of God? We need to leave our personal, limited perspective behind. We need to wash away our own limitations before we can come and have true Avodat Hashem. And so before the introduction of Chet HaEgel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts the Kiyor. The Kiyor which says that if you're going to come into my Beit HaMikdash, if you're coming to come into my Mishkan, before you come to serve me, make sure that you're serving me and wash away any incorrect notions of what you think I am. Make sure you're not serving yourself, make sure that you're serving me. And so even though the Kiyor should have been in Parshat Truma, the Kiyor has to be here in Parshat Kitisa. The Trufa is put before the Machala. The healing is put before it even comes along. Now you'll tell me, that's a nice idea. You'll tell me that's a nice idea, washing away the sins and all of these, washing away your perspectives and all of these things. But it's actually inherent even deeper than that in the very essence of the Kiyor itself. Is anybody familiar with the Rashi which explains what the Kiyor was actually made out of? Excellent. Word for word, basically. Amar lo kadosh baruch hu kabel ki elu chavevin alai min hakol shal yedehem he'emidu hanashim hatzvaot. This is Rashi on Shmuel Perek Lamechet Pasuk Chet on Mar'ot hatzvaot that the women brought these copper mirrors, says Sima, that they used in order to beautify themselves for what? To make themselves attractive to their husbands, to make sure that even though there was a decree to kill the Jewish males, that they would continue to produce a Klal Yisrael. I can't speak for you, and I'm not trying to gender discriminate. But I suspect this might resonate with some people here or people you know. Imagine a woman coming up to a mirror which is designed to reflect herself for the purpose of beautifying herself. And imagine the tremendous internal Avodat Hashem of taking that moment of pure selfishness, of pure focus on oneself, on literally one's own image, and taking all of that and transforming it into an experience of focusing it entirely on Avodat Hashem. Dedicating all of that specifically to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Looking in that mirror and using it for what it's intended for and beautifying herself. To do what? To make herself attractive, to make sure that she brings continuity to the Jewish people. Nothing to do with her external beauty. Only utilizing it as a means to an end. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants collected to create this Kiyor. It's not just in terms of what it's embodying in washing away one's own limited perceptions. It's literally using one's limited perceptions, putting it and making it into a kiyor to wash oneself off before one goes and does true Avodat Hashem. And that makes sense, because who doesn't involve themselves in Chet HaEgel? The women. Aaron tells the men, go and take the jewelry off your wives. Why doesn't he just say, go to your wives and get their jewelry? Because Aaron also knew, not only was he buying time, he was hoping, big move for Aaron, who was always looking for Shalom Bayis, there's certain things which trump even that, right? He knew the women weren't going to give it up. Weren't going to give up their jewelry sue their husbands. And so it says, the pasuk emphasizes, that they went and took, they grabbed the jewelry to go and make the Egel Azav. Because the women weren't going to do that. They understood what it means to be true Ovdot Hashem and Ovedet Hashem. They were the ones who made the Kiyor. They walked in with that perspective. And it's the men who don't chop that. And the women are therefore not subject to that sin. And it's the women from coming from that same place of having given up those very mirrors, which they used only for the purpose of beautifying themselves in order to continue the Jewish people, in order to make the Kiyor itself. Last piece. The Mishkan here is referred to at the beginning of Pekudei. We've referenced this Rashi before. Eile Pekudei Mishkan, Mishkan Ha'idut. These are the reckonings of the Mishkan of testimony. What's the Mishkan testifying to? What did we say, I think, three Shirim ago? We quoted this Rashi. What is it that the Mishkan is actually testifying to? Says Rashi, Perak Lamechet Pasuk Chaf Aleph, on Mishkan Ha'idut, Eidut Li Yisrael, Shevitir Lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al Ma'aseh Ha'Egel. It's a testimony that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgave them for the Ma'aseh Ha'Egel. Sha'arei Kishra Shkinato Benehem, that He rested His presence within them. Kadosh Baruch Hu tells us to build a Mishkan. Let's go back to that Kodesh HaKadoshim again. What's in the center of the Kodesh HaKadoshim? The Kruvim. Right, it's always the answer to that question. The Kruvim. What are the Kruvim? Literally. Not a trick question. Two angelic figures made out of gold. What does that sound a lot like? Pimazov. It's an image that we would never ever forge under any other circumstance, made also out of gold, and it also sits there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. What's the difference? On the most simple levels, don't start thinking like we normally think of this year. Simplest of levels. What's the difference between the Kruvim and the Egel Azav? On the simplest of levels. That's it. That's it. God said so. Back to everything we've talked about until now. One, God said so. One, God didn't. One, God asked for. One, God didn't. One, God said, this is service of me. One, we said, this is what we think is service of God. And even though both of them are golden carved images, one of them is Avodah Zarah, and one of them sits in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The singular difference is God commanded one and God didn't command the other. There are obviously hashkafic differences between them as well. And that's why they're not the same image. But on the basic level, on the most simple level, God commands one and not the other. And again, and again, and again, and again in Parshiot Vayakal Pekudei, when we actually build the Mishkan post Chet HaEgel, we show that we've internalized the message of Chet HaEgel. A few dozen times, the paragraphs keep on ending with, I'll give you one example, but again and again and again, ad nauseum. Excellent. Every single stage ends the same way. Vayar Moshe, and this is the concluding paragraph of the whole Mishkan itself, but it's by every single stage as well. Vayar Moshe et kol hamelacha, v'nei asu ota, kasher siva Hashem, kein asu. Kasher tziva Hashem kein asu. They did it like the way that God intended.
Thanks.
Okay. Last piece. Kol hakavod to all of you for sticking this out. But this is incredibly essential pieces of Avodas Hashem. This is actually new for me. I've heard my Rebbe give over. I mean, I've adapted a lot of this shiur over time, and there are pieces of mine and pieces of his. But in the context of Kitisa, so this is actually new for me, and I hope I'm giving it over clearly. I'll try my best. Why do we start off the parsha with Shkalim? Why do we start off the parsha with Shkalim? What is shkalim all about? Why do we ask all of Klal Yisrael to give these shkalim? For what purpose that we said before?
Counting.
To count them. Why do we make to give shkalim? Why not just count them?
You're not supposed to count.
Say it stronger. It's usher to count people. It's usher to count people. We're not allowed to count people. So much so, there's actually an individual in Jewish history who, according to the Gemara, according to Psukim, the Satan tricks into counting the Jewish people. Are you familiar with who that is? David HaMelech. We learned about it in Midrashan next semester, hopefully. Right? With Shoshana. David HaMelech counts the Jewish people. The Satan tricks him into doing it. And he goes and he counts the Jewish people, and what happens? The Navi comes and tells him, I'm giving you three choices. You can choose whatever you want, but something bad's about to happen. You just get to choose what it is. And he chooses a plague. And a plague comes and starts wiping out the Jewish people because David HaMelech counted them. To the point where David HaMelech sees that it's about to come on Yerushalayim. He davens to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for it to stop. It stops at that spot. And he recognizes this spot is Makom HaMikdash. Spoiler alert. This is Makom HaMikdash. Right? I feel like after a few thousand years, it's okay to assume that everybody's read the book. But that's the spot of Beit HaMikdash. Because we're not allowed to count people. There's something inherently wrong about counting. Something inherently negative about counting. I don't have here enough time to go through all of the sources, and I don't have all of them in front of me either. But one of the key sources in the discussion is that the Gemara tells us that bracha is unable to rest in a place where things are counted. Anyone familiar with that concept? In a bracha shura b'makom she something in ayin. I forget exactly the wording of the Gemara there. Bracha doesn't rest in a place where things are counted. Bracha is the concept we talked about before as multiplicity. Also back to the Yaakov Shirim. Bet, Reish, Chaf, they're all 220, 200, they're all the Gematria letters that relate to multiplicity moving into twos, into moving further, into moving beyond, of the multiplicity that exists in reality. Yosef Hashem Aleichem, Aleichem Ve'al Benichem, when we want to be Mosif, when you want to add, Yosef Hashem Aleichem, Aleichem Benichem, I'm going to add, says God, when I've added to you, what are you? Bruchim Atem LaHashem. Bracha is adding more and adding more and adding more, and we can't do that once we've counted. Now that would seem like a very odd concept, but we've actually have modern day science that supports this. Maybe not on the realm that we normally exist in, but if you go down in physics, very, very small, and you take a look at something like electrons, right? You have, saying this right, I'm trying to like draw back from when I learned this. I was always fascinated by these things, but I never had the math skills to pull it off. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, is that correct?
There is such a concept, yeah.
So what is the concept of, you tell me, what's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle?
That whenever you're trying to look at an electron, you can't ever tell exactly where it is because the vision of like the light that you use to look at it makes it move. So.
You can either know one of two things. You can either know what's going on more generally without any specifics, but the second that, according to physics, the second that I identify, I isolate the exact position of that electron, I've lost out on the possibilities that could exist that were existing simultaneously beforehand. When we count something, even on a physical realm, when we identify something, we fix it, we limit it. And on a quantum level, that's what's happening. That's what science has shown us. But it even exists, it's reflected in the physical realm. When we count something, we limit it. We no longer allow the bracha to come into that item. There's an infinite potential in something until I come and I count it and I limit it. By counting it, I cut it off from the potential to be influenced, from the potential to receive from its infinite source. Right back to our Ela and our Me. The purpose of the process of the Shkalim is to emphasize the fact, don't get lost in counting, in limiting yourself to the limitations of the physical world and assuming that that's where things stop. You start counting things, you limit them, you imagine in your brain that's all that there is, and by doing that, you inherently cut things off from its infinite source. Says the Torah, don't count the people. Whatever you do, don't count the people. You will be cutting them off from their infinite source. You'll be cutting them off from bracha. And so Shkalim is also the introduction to this very parsha, because it's emphasizing the concept that we don't allow ourselves as Jews to be limited by the way things present themselves in the physical world. In fact, to a certain extent, we try to keep ourselves from doing that, to make sure that we always are relating to the infinite bestowal that's coming and giving it life and giving it its true existence. In terms of at least tying some aspects of this parsha together. As an aside, that very same, I only noticed this today, and I didn't look at it in its full context, but as B'derech HaAfshar, that very pasuk that we just read, which is the final time where it emphasizes, where they did it exactly as HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted. They only did what HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked, and that was the only way they limited themselves by what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told them to do. Perek Lamed Pasuk Mem Gimel, Vayar Moshe et Kol HaMelacha, V'niasu Otam, we said this is another, the emphasis on, Kasher Tziva Hashem Kein Asu. What's the exact conclusion of that? How does that end? How does that story conclude? Perek Lamed Tet Pasuk Mem Gimel? Vayivarech Otam Moshe. Bracha is able to come down. Because they're relating to God as He wants to be related to, which is from His infinite essence and not from any limited perspective that we have. Also, but there are half sharp. But it's striking to me that that's... What's the next pasuk there? Then we already move out of the realm of constructing those pieces of the Mishkan, and we put up the Mishkan itself. But that's it. We create all of these finite pieces of the Mishkan, but we do it kashir tziva Hashem et Moshe, kein asu. And then it allows it to bring bracha inside of it. Strikingly to me, my Rebbe didn't address this directly. But again, B'derech HaAfshar, he didn't come to conclude the discussion that even he brought up that we emphasized three shiurim ago. I'm thinking to a certain extent out loud, put this together way too early this morning. But why are there these two presentations of the command to build the Mishkan, then Chet HaEgel, and then the building of the Mishkan itself? There is a command to build the Mishkan. The Mishkan is the ultimate response to Matan Torah that we've been talking about. We're told we have to build a Mishkan, and to the extent that you build a Mishkan, you are to actually validate having the Torah, because the Torah has to come in and have a Shekhinah, the presence of God resting in this world. And this is how it is meant to be, in the image of the Mishkan in Parshat Vayakal and Parshat Truman Tetzaveh. What's the last piece that we're missing? What's being emphasized here that causes the interruption of Parshat Ki Tisa, and then brings us to Vayakal Pekudeh? The Torah requires of you that you bring the Shekhinah into the world. You don't leave it up on the mountain. You bring it back down. You bring a Kadosh Baruch Hu to live in this world. But what do you need to make sure of? That what you're bringing into this world is really a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And don't get in the way of that. Because that goes and transforms the goal of this world, which is Avodat Hashem, into the antithesis of what this world is about, which is Avodah Zarah. Here they were building something. They were creating, they made for themselves what they thought was something which was serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but they did it in their own image. They were serving themselves. Be very, very careful once Parshat Ki Tisa. If you want to do it, you've got to do it the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do it. And therefore, go on to Vayakal Bakudi and actually build what I want you to build. Kasher Tziva Hashem Moshe Kein Asu. And emphasize that again and again and again. You build me exactly what I'm telling you to, because you make sure that when you're bringing my Shekhinah into the world, you're bringing me into the world and not anything else. And so Ki Tisa stands between the concept of what the Mishkan is and says it's not a concept of what the Mishkan is. It's the concept of what the Mishkan is. It's that fine line that stands between Ratzon Hashem, Avodat Hashem, and Avodat Hatzmacha. And Rebbe didn't actually address that question, which we put so prominently on the board so many days ago. And I think that's why Kadosh Baruch Hu was intentionally inserting it here, dividing it between the command and the practice. Because the way that we enact it in the world, where we're coming from, how we do it, if we relate to it in that way, that's what defines what it is, and that's what brings the Shekhinah into the world. And so it has to stand between the two. Because it's not just about creating spirituality in the world. It's about bringing a spiritual reality to the world that Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to be here for God. Relating to God as He is, what He wants as He wants it here. That's a Mishkan. That's a Bayit. That's a Bayit with Shalom Bayit, and we'll talk about that more next time. That's how to really create it, is if it's really focused on bringing Kadosh Baruch Hu as He wants to be brought down. In the way that He is, as close to His essence as we can get. Not with the limitation of seeing Him as Elohim or Din or whatever it is. We're bringing Kadosh Baruch Hu into the world. So, I think that was actually the longest parsha we've ever had. Again, we still missed out on so much, and it pains me to have to skip forward past the rest of Ki Tisa. The only significance that I'm aware of that actually has any meaning in the context of a birthday is this very koch, the koch HaBracha. So, more so than any other end of the shir, I give us all a bracha, that Bezrat Hashem, we should be able to see with clarity what the Kadosh Baruch Hu is as He wants to be understood, as He gives Himself over to us through the MS of His Torah, and that we make sure that we're all serving a Kadosh Baruch Hu from our own internal space in the Bilvavi Mishkan Evna inside of ourselves, from our Kodesh HaKodeshim, Bezrat Hashem, from a place of true Avodat Hashem, complete focus on the other, complete focus on a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and bring Him the MS into the world in a way where He's Mashreb, both in the world and very much inside of ourselves as well.